From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we talk with British film director John Schlesinger. His credits include Midnight Cowboy, Marathon Man, The Falcon and the Snowman, and last year's Madame Szaszka. Also today, the necessity of empty places. Writer Paul Grukow tells us why we must maintain some connection with the wilderness, in spite of all the modern conditions conspiring against it. And we have reviews by jazz critic Evan Whitehead and television critic David Bianculli. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. British film director John Schlesinger made his first American movie in 1969 and won Academy Awards for Best Director and Best Film. The film was Midnight Cowboy with Dustin Hoffman and John Voight. Since then, Schlesinger has divided his time between England and the United States. He's been making movies since 1961. They include Billy Liar, Darling, Sunday Bloody Sunday, Marathon Man, The Falcon and the Snowman, and The Believers. Schlesinger first learned about movie making by acting and making documentaries for British television. His latest film, Madame Szaszka, has just been released on video. It stars Shirley MacLaine as a Russian-American piano teacher living in London. Szaszka takes on young students with the potential for greatness and teaches them about life as well as music. She's strong-willed, temperamental, and jealous of other influences on her students. But under her guidance, several students have become brilliant pianists. Her new student is a 15-year-old boy of Indian heritage. In this scene, Madame Szaszka meets with the boy's mother.
No. I can take your son on Tuesdays and Thursdays. No, Tuesdays and Fridays.
Oh, but he helps me on Fridays. It's a very busy day for me with the weekend orders.
Mrs. Sen, whenever I take on a new student, I give myself and my time totally and freely. It is an absolute commitment for both of us, the student and myself. Because, you see, I teach not only how to play the piano, but how to live. You'll be very proud of your son. Now there are two of us to care.
John Schlesinger, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You've always said that you're more interested in themes relating to failure than success, and I wonder how that applies to your new film, Madame Szaszka.
Well, I think actually it's about people that have to deal with both. The problems of being successful and the problems of having been a failure. Which we all, every artist, I think, suffers or has to endure during his lifetime. And how do you deal with both and keep going and surmount all obstacles, I think, is one of the themes of this film, and certainly one of the important things of one's life.
I guess it's something you've had to deal with your film, success and failure.
Absolutely, all my life.
This is the first film role Shirley MacLaine has taken since Terms of Endearment, and I was wondering how you cast her in it.
Well, I'd admired her very much over the years, but particularly in Terms of Endearment, where I thought she'd shown extraordinary kind of courage in playing that role and appearing in all kinds of ages and conditions. And I needed a very courageous actress. Originally, we weren't looking for an American. It was written for a Russian, for a European. Certainly. And when we decided to ask Shirley, who was my first choice in the States, I, for some reason, hadn't expected her to be as enthusiastic about the role in the film as she was. But she made an instant kind of identification with the part and excitement for the film and made a commitment which has been quite wonderful.
Shirley MacLaine and the young Indian actor who plays her student are both not musicians. What is it like to work with actors who aren't musicians but are playing pianists?
Make sure you've got a very good musician who understands the problems of an actor having to play a musician who is quite brilliant. I mean, Shirley, after all, is musical. I mean, she's been brought up in the musical theatre and she was a dancer. So her background is certainly a musical one, and she understood all that and has indeed played a bit of piano in her time. Naveen Chowdhury, who plays opposite her as Manik in the film, the young, brilliant 15-year-old student, of the piano, had never played a note of music in his life. I think he plays drums.
It must have been fun to hear this actor play when he was just hitting any note, but making it look
right.
We've
silenced the piano as quickly as we could, because really did sound awful. So from the very word go, he was always playing to playback or to a disc of some kind.
I want to get back to this idea that you've, in many of your films, been more interested in failure than success. You know, when Rocky came along, Hollywood, anyways, got very success-oriented in its movies. Was that a bad turn for you?
No, because when you use failure rather too heavily, I think. I mean, in a sense, Midnight Cowboy was about two failures, but they won, in a sense, at the end, because they'd learned something through their relationship and so forth. And even though he was dying, Ratso Rizzo did make it to Miami and died there. So in my view, that's not total failure. I think what I mean by being more interested in failure is trying to cope with it, in making the necessary compromises to that. If it was about success only, that would be too obvious for my taste. I mean, I think that it's the negative things that one has to deal with in life, make compromises over, make adjustments to, win against, that really interests me. It's the problems that failure throws up, I suppose.
I'd like to talk with you about some of your best-known films, and since we've already brought up Midnight Cowboy, why don't we start with that? This was the first film that you made in the United States.
Yes.
And John Voight stars as a someone from the South, right?
From
the South or the Midwest,
from Texas.
Yeah, who moves to New York, and he thinks he's going to become this great stud, but instead of hustling other people, everybody else basically hustles him. And one of the people who he meets is Ratso Rizzo, played by Dustin Hoffman. And I'd like to play the bar scene in which these two characters meet, and the part of the scene that we're playing opens with John Voight being kind of propositioned by a transvestite.
Hi, cowboy. Got a cigarette?
Hey, sweetheart.
More damn faggots in this town.
Oh, kiss it, Ratso.
Up yours. You gotta watch out for that.
Hey, you really know the ropes. Oh, damn, I wish I bumped into you before. I'm Joe Buck from Texas.
Enrico Rizzo from the Bronx.
And I'm gonna buy you a drink. What the hell do you think of that?
Well, I don't mind if I do.
Bartender, drinks all around. One for my friend here, too. And I know when I give satisfaction, I give her satisfaction. I mean, you see what I'm getting at here? She got a penthouse up there with a color TV, more diamonds than the Archbishop. And she busts out bowling when I ask her for money.
For what?
For money.
Wait a minute. For money for what?
Oh, hell, I'm a hustler. You didn't know that?
Now, how am I supposed to know that? I mean, you got to tell a person these things.
I'm a hustler.
It's a scene from Midnight Cowboy. Now, this is the story of someone who comes from Texas to New York and really doesn't know his way around and makes a lot of mistakes while learning the ropes. This was your first film in America. Did you empathize at all since you were new to the country yourself?
Totally. I mean, that was the reason I thought I could make the film, because in a sense, New York is a fantasy for the cowboy. And he thinks, he imagines it as one thing, and then the reality turns out to be something quite different. And I suppose in a way I could sympathise, empathise with that. And most of the films that I made in the States have in some way been about fantasy or fantasists. And I felt that that was something I really could relate to.
You worked with Dustin Hoffman in this film before he really became a star. I think you actually cast him before The Graduate came out.
No, The Graduate was already out, and I didn't believe that he was a character actor until I actually met him, dressed for the role. He came to meet me in New York, and we walked around 42nd Street, and he was wearing a dirty old raincoat, and kind of melded in so perfectly with the background that he got the part by the end of the evening. And all I'd got to go on was the reputation as a character actor and having seen him in The Graduate playing a very different kind of role.
When he was walking around in that raincoat, was that something he was doing to prove to you how good a character actor he could be, or is that just the way he was dressed?
No, he was trying to prove.
Oh, okay,
he was trying to
checking.
Get the part, I reckon, yes.
I think when this movie came out, it was X-rated.
Yes.
Initially.
Yes, it was.
It seems pretty tame by today's standards. I mean, there's four-letter words in it and some nudity, but it's still... You think it would have gotten an X today?
No. It very quickly lost its X, in fact.
Oh.
After the Oscars.
Did you fight for that? Or did you just...
No, at the time, I think Jerry Hellman, the producer, and I both felt, you know, okay, that's probably what it should get. It was the X rating then meant something quite different to the rating now. Mm-hmm. I mean, when it got an R rating, they'd already changed the meanings of what X rating represented.
Midnight Cowboy was your first film in the United States. Why did you want to make an American film?
Oh, I thought the book was extraordinary, and it would give me an opportunity to deal with an American theme. I hadn't, until I read the book, I'd had no ambition actually to come here to work. And when I read it, I thought, this is a hell of a story, and I understand these two characters, even though I don't know them, really. And I came to America on the heels of a tremendous failure, Far From the Madding Crowd, which was a quite tough baptism of fire. And I stayed on in Los Angeles after it had opened there and flopped rather badly, working on the screenplay of Midnight Cowboy with Waldo Salt, and hung around, you know, Hollywood Boulevard, which is a fairly sleazy area. And some of the things in the film I saw and experienced on the boulevard, and then came to New York. And with Waldo, we trudged the streets of New York, experiencing more things, all of which have a place in the movie. And it was a very interesting period of my life, because I came to the States to promote a film which hadn't worked, so I knew what rejection in Hollywood terms meant and how, and then started to work on this next movie and really got more and more hooked and intrigued by the whole subject.
Well, Midnight Cowboy was made in 1969. Let me ask you about a film you made a couple of years later in England, Sunday Bloody Sunday.
And yes.
This film starred Glenda Jackson and Peter Finch as two people both in love with the same man, a bisexual man. Was it hard to get backing to do this movie? It was not a moralistic film that preached against homosexuality.
No, it certainly wasn't. No, it was, and funnily enough, though the subject was tough, I suppose, the fact that Midnight Cowboy was so successful enabled me to get backing fairly quickly from United Artists, who'd also distributed Midnight Cowboy. And I remember the remark of David Picker, who was running the company, head of production at that time. I don't quite know where this script is taking us, but if you want to do it, do it. It's not going to cost too much, and we did.
There's a scene where Peter Finch and Murray Head, the actor who plays the bisexual man, kiss. And it was really a very brave scene for the time, for 1971.
Yes, that was ahead of its time.
Did you have to fight to include that?
No, I didn't have to fight to include it. I mean, some very strange things happened. I mean, the actors didn't object to doing it because they realised that it was quite important. And I felt it had to be treated just as an everyday occurrence. I mean, Penelope Gilliatt, who wrote the screenplay, and I had some quite serious arguments about the scene, because she felt it should be kind of done in long shot and silhouette, and in a sense made a special deal of by trying to throw it away. And I felt it should just happen in front of the camera with no big deal as part of their everyday behaviour in private. And that's the way we did it. And there were objections, certainly, in the cinema. I remember one of the first screenings in America, a woman nudged her husband in front of me and said, "Come on, Harry, let's get out. This is not a film for nice people." And Peter Finch's wife could never quite get used to it when she came to the opening at Venice Festival. I remember she screamed out loud when the kiss happened. And I said before the London premiere, "Now, please, just keep your trap shut. You know it's coming. Shut up." But she couldn't resist screaming again. So I was very glad when she wasn't on the road with us in America.
It's really funny. She'd probably seen her husband getting killed in movies.
Yes, but the
didn't
idea,
get this kind of reaction.
No, this was more horrendous to her, I guess. Anyway, it was a film that I think was probably ahead of its time, and I don't think that the United Artists expected it to have the kind of critical success it did, And I'm very glad that it got the attention it did. And by some strange trick of fate now in London, in England, there's a new law, Clause 28, which has just been passed, which forbids any local authority to back anything that encourages or is seen to promote the cause of homosexuality.
So are you saying that you think you wouldn't have been able to make that scene?
No, now I'm saying this film, 20 years after the event, could not be included in any kind of special festival of films financed by a local government body, as it would be seen to promote the cause of homosexuality, thus putting us back to over 20 years in censorship. It's quite ludicrous, and we're all fighting it.
How are you fighting it?
By a great deal of protest. It is law now, and they say it's not intended to, you know, ban the works of Oscar Wilde in the local public library or so on and so forth. But I think that it could play into the hands of the really bigoted, of which there are plenty about.
It must be very disturbing to feel that things are going backwards.
Yes, very, indeed. I think it's a state of affairs which has been brought on by a number of things, including the paranoia and the lack of understanding and the fear of AIDS, I guess.
British film director John Schlesinger is my guest. His latest film, Madame Suzatska, has just been released on video. It stars Shirley MacLaine. Schlesinger also directed Midnight Cowboy, Sunday Bloody Sunday, and The Falcon and the Snowman. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Ask you about the film Marathon Man. You made this in 1976. It also starred Dustin Hoffman. As a graduate student who unwittingly becomes involved in international espionage, now the most talked about scene in this movie is the dental torture scene in which Dustin Hoffman is tortured by Laurence Olivier. Olivier plays a Nazi doctor who uses his dentistry as a technique to extract information from people under torture. I want to just play this scene and then talk with you about making it. So this is Laurence Olivier and Dustin Hoffman.
Oh, please don't worry. I'm not going into that cavity. That nerve's already dying. A live, freshly cut nerve is infinitely more sensitive.
So I'll just drill into a healthy tooth until I reach the pulp. Unless, of course, you can tell me that it's safe.
Not very pretty, is it?
It's worse on sound than it is in vision, in fact.
No, it's more like the real thing where you have your eyes clenched shut and you're just hearing the sounds of the drill.
Yes, you never ever see it in the film. You never see drill on tooth. It's all suggested by eyes and by the drill coming towards the camera.
Well, civilians never really do see what that looks like. Only dentists get to see that.
No, but I mean, the audience never see it.
Right. But I mean, it's more like the way you experience
it. Yes, absolutely.
Because you don't see the drill hitting your teeth when you're in a dentist's office.
No, but you see it coming towards your mouth. And that scene, I mean, had everybody squirming. It was in the book, Bill Gohman's book, and I thought it was a terrific scene. But we had to do it very artfully. Though I knew that it was literally a nerve that would hit, when hit, would affect everyone, certainly me. Because I think very often you put things into films which affect you one way and another, certainly things that terrify you, and the dentist, going to the dentist, always terrified me. So it was a scene that I felt very, very strongly identification with.
Did you want to make the scene as horrible as possible, or did you want to keep it medium horrible?
I wanted to make it feel, but I didn't want it to be gloating over the violence of it, which is why we never showed anything graphic. It was all suggested. And the first moment that you hear the whir of the of the motor of the drill. You don't even see it. It's behind the lid of a suitcase, which is opened. I always think that everything is better suggested and leave the rest to the audience imagination, where possible.
It wouldn't surprise me if there was more than once when you were in the dentist chair and your dentist before undoing the drill gave you his impressions or her impressions of this scene. Has that happened to you?
Well, I must confess that since the film, I've been probably more scared of going to the dentist for fear that they'd get revenge. But I know my dentist quite well. And funnily enough, dentists that I've been to have always rather enjoyed the film. So they haven't tortured me too badly.
Well, good. Another film I want to ask you about, The Falcon and the Snowman, made in 1984. It starred Timothy Hutton and Sean Penn as Christopher Boyce and Andrew Lee. Was that the other person's name?
Dalton Lee.
Dalton
yes.
Lee, yeah. Yes. And this is based on the true story of two young upper-middle-class men who sold secrets to the Soviets.
Yeah.
Very good performances in this. I want to play an excerpt of a scene where Timothy Hutton and Sean Penn are at the airport, and Penn has also been dealing drugs, and he's been getting high and hooked on his own drugs, and it's made him very paranoid, and he thinks that Timothy Hutton is going to turn on him and betray him.
Yes.
I'm not stupid, Chris. I read books.
What are you talking about?
I know what it's called. Disinformation. Counter-espionage.
What?
You're backed by the company.
Oh, Jesus.
You're one of them. The CIA's got a picture of Oswald, and they've got one of me, too, and that's all part of the plan. So it's okay. It's okay. So what happens next? You throw me in the wolves? You throw me in the wolves?
Look at that. It's doing to you.
It's the only thing keeping me safe.
It's killing you.
It's the only thing keeping me safe. I don't know who my friends are anymore. I don't know who to trust. I don't know. Just don't throw me to the wolves.
Right, now, listen, you leave your bags behind. We're going to get on the plane and get out of here. We'll go home.
It's a very interesting performance from Sean Penn, yeah. In part because he's always seen as being an almost sex symbol. And in this movie, he's such a flake.
Yeah.
He's so out of control and out of control of his mind and
yeah.
And
such
and
a fantasist. That's, again, it's the element of fantasy which attracted me to the character.
How did you tune up the performance with him and decide, even that whiny voice that he uses throughout so much of the movie?
Well, it happened, I think. It evolved during rehearsal. Both Timothy Hutton and to a certain extent, Sean Penn, met the protagonist they were playing in jail. They visited them. Timothy Hutton had quite a long and close relationship, as close as it could ever get, over the telephone and occasional visits with Chris Boyce himself.
Chris Boyce was the real spy that this is based on.
Yes. And
did you approve of that, of them going to jail and visiting?
I let them do it. I couldn't stand in their way. The only thing that there is always a problem about, reenacting a real person that exists, because there's always other bits of information you get which the actor playing the part thinks is vital. Oh, my goodness, that happened. We must show that. We must show this. And that can complicate, a screenplay which is fairly tight. And there were times when we had to alter things, or felt it right to alter things, from information that we'd got from the real people in life through the actors. But I thought that the scene you've just played was going to be one of the most difficult to shoot, and it didn't turn out to be. I think that Sean Penn had prepared for it very well and knew what the high was like, had experienced it before, and played it. We did very few takes. We shot it in the airport at Mexico City. And I thought we would have to sort of gear up to it many times and would want to build a set in the studio, but we couldn't afford to do that. So we went out to do it on location in the airport, and it actually worked terribly well and very quickly.
Yeah, it's a very good scene. You entered the film industry in England right after the Second World War. What kind of state was the movie industry in when you...
Well, I tried to get into it after the Second World War. I made... when I was a student, amateur student film about a hanging in the 17th century that had actually taken place on a hill near where my family lived. And it got some attention. It was just a student film. And years. Then I became a professional actor, so I didn't go into the film industry immediately because, as usual, there was a slump, as there always seemed to be permanently slumps in different countries' film industry, and there certainly is often in England. And I tried, having made this student film, to get a job as a T-boy or an assistant, and couldn't. So I became a professional actor for some years, made a small documentary about Hyde Park, which got shown by BBC Television, and eventually got in through television, making small documentaries for magazine programmes. And that got me my break, finally.
What about working with actors? Do you have a certain style in working with them? Do you like to let them bring what they want to a performance, or do you try to pretty strictly guide what they do?
Well, I have very strong visual images of what I want to do with the film before I start shooting. And within those parameters, I feel that the actors must be given freedom to express themselves as much as they can. I mean, I think they've got a great deal to add to a film. If I respect the actors, there are some actors that are very selfish and need hitting hard, and some that are very inexperienced and frightened and need help. But the majority of them, I've found, are people that you're collaborating with in a spirit of very sort of warm creation, in a sense. You've got to give them space to feel free, to make fools of themselves if necessary, and then you are there to hold them down and to tell them where to taper down a performance. Because acting for the movies isn't really acting, it's being a character. And as long as I feel I'm trusted and I trust them, then I think there's an extremely fruitful atmosphere for collaboration.
Do you think that having acted before you started directing has made you more sensitive to the actors that you work with?
I think I know what their problems are when they come on the set and everybody's hanging around and there's pressure, which there always is, to get a performance as quickly as possible. And I admire good screen acting tremendously. I mean, there are certain favourite actors I have who, like Peter Finch had and Alan Bates has, which is the quality of conceal. There's more there, and it doesn't all show itself at once. Some actors, you see the performance, and they can be very good actors and very good performances, but you don't feel there's a reserve, greater emotional reserve underneath, which the best screen actors, I think, have. Monty Clift had it in spades.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your directing. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
John Schlesinger's latest film, Madame Suzatska, has just been released on video. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with the manager of the Oakland A's, Tony La Russa. Last year, La Russa took his team to the World Series, and he was named Manager of the Year. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In his wilderness essays, Paul Grewkow writes of magnificent vistas and towering mountains. He also writes about mosquitoes, being lost, bad camping food, and coming down with altitude sickness. Coming up, Paul Grewkow talks about his latest collection of essays, The Necessity of Empty Places. Also, television critic David Bianculli looks back on last week's Miami Vice finale. And jazz critic Evan Whitehead reviews the reissue of pianist Cecil Taylor's 1973 album, Indent. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. Political and military officials have begun to challenge Chinese Premier Li Peng's declaration of martial law in Beijing. More than 100 top army officers earlier today signed a letter to the People's Daily vowing not to enter the center of the city or to use violence to end the current pro-democracy demonstrations. There were reports of a clash between soldiers and protesters in southwest Beijing, but witnesses said the troops withdrew after causing a number of injuries among the protesters. Meanwhile, there is also a reported move by some members of China's legislature to overturn the martial law decree. The diplomatic rift between Britain and the Soviet Union widened today, with Moscow threatening further action against British nationals. Vera Frankel reports from London.
The current row between Moscow and London dates back to last Friday, when the Thatcher government expelled 11 Soviet diplomats and journalists it said were spies. Britain said Moscow had forced its hand by ignoring warnings and allowing KGB spying activities in Britain to rise to unacceptable levels. But in a tit-for-tat response, Moscow yesterday ordered out the same number of British diplomats and journalists. For a short while, it looked as though matters would be allowed to rest there. But today, Moscow hardened its position. It has threatened to cut the number of people allowed to work at British establishments in Moscow, to match the number of Soviet nationals permitted to work in Britain. Details of the Soviet plan are sketchy, but at a press conference in Moscow today, a Soviet spokesman said it could mean that some 170 Britons will have to return home. This is Vera Frankel in London.
Secretary of State James Baker used his toughest language yet today about the Israeli-Arab conflict, telling a pro-Israel lobbying group that Israel must begin to think of Palestinians in the occupied territories as neighbors deserving a political voice. Baker said it's high time for a serious dialogue between Israel and Palestinians. He told the AIPAC group that Israel must stop its actions in the territories, reopen schools there, and give up, quote, the unrealistic vision of a greater Israel. Baker also called on Arab countries to serve as a catalyst to the peace process by taking concrete steps to accommodate Israel rather than plan for its destruction. In Bonn today, there were signs that the West Germans are coming closer to the U.S. position on negotiations over short-range missiles. But it is still uncertain if a compromise can be found before the NATO summit next week. More from Deirdre Berger.
For weeks, there have been serious differences of opinion between Bonn and Washington over the modernization of NATO short-range missiles. The Germans say they do not think NATO should make a decision to deploy a new system until 1992. In addition, the Germans want to start negotiations with the Soviet Union over the reduction of short-range missiles. In contrast, Washington has insisted that no short-range negotiations should even be considered until the Soviets agree to and implement a cutback on conventional forces. Today, Bonn government speaker Johnny Klein indicated the West Germans are ready to accept Washington's position to hold off on short-range negotiations. But other top West German officials today said there are still large differences of opinion between Bonn and Washington on the issue. Officials on both sides are continuing to press for an agreement before the NATO summit meeting in Brussels next week. For National Public Radio, this is Deirdre Berger in Cologne.
Former Air Force General Richard Secord pleaded innocent today to new charges in connection with the Iran-Contra scandal. The new charges involve allegations that Secord lied to Congress in its probe of the Arms for Hostages deal. The charges stem from Secord's testimony as the first witness before the Select House and Senate Committees in 1987. It is his second indictment in the Iran-Contra affair. Stock prices were fractionally higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained just under 1 point to close at 2502.02. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The music of jazz pianist and composer Cecil Taylor is highly structured, but it's often associated with the free jazz of the 1960s. Some have said it's hard to warm up to, but jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says that isn't so, and if you give him a few minutes, Kevin will try to prove it.
Cecil Taylor's been making records for almost 35 years, but some listeners still find him hard to get a fix on, and one or two older critics still hint he might be a charlatan. It's easy to hear what puts some people off. Cecil Taylor attacks the piano with more gusto than anyone else. He'll let loose with dense clusters of notes, and he doesn't improvise from familiar tunes. On the other hand, his musical language fully exploits the piano's resources, and the principles underlying it are straight out of African-American jazz and blues traditions. His music is readily accessible to those willing to hear it. Because Cecil Taylor had some early training at the New England Conservatory, and because his music is so dissonant, he's often pegged as being heavily influenced by atonal European music. But Taylor has insisted he learned more from listening to Duke Ellington than he did at the conservatory. He's also said he considers himself a blues improviser. That's a useful observation, if you think of the blues not as a clear-cut 12-bar form built on three basic chords, but as a pattern of call and response, which stems from 19th century work songs. Taylor's music, like instrumental blues, is derived from the sound of the voice and the percussive sounds of the drum and the clanging hammer. Cecil Taylor's recital Indent, recorded live in 1973, is a three-movement solo piece. It was just reissued as a CD on the Freedom label. Indent is one of the best introductions to Taylor's music because it captures him in full fire and because its organizing principles are fairly easy to spot. Much of the music is built on the interval of the minor third, from the note G down to E, for example. That interval is a cornerstone of piano blues and makes up the riff used in Willie Dixon's blues classic, Spoonful. Cecil Taylor's music is less overtly traditional than Willie Dixon's, but it springs from the same blues roots, as virtually all jazz does. The structure of a traditional blues verse is simple. A line is sung, then repeated with a slight melodic variation. Then comes the third and final line, which springs from what precedes it. Sometimes, Taylor's method is pretty similar. In the opening minute of Indent, he'll take a kernel of melody, add a few notes to it, and stretch it until it evolves into another figure, at which time the whole process begins again. When he needs creative replenishment, he'll return to the original phrase and start over. Taylor works with themes and variations, much the way Louis Armstrong did, except that Taylor's themes keep mutating. Thank you. Cecil Taylor's quick change music might seem in keeping with the short attention spans of the so-called TV generation. But what makes Indent so rewarding is hearing how Taylor keeps investigating the same basic materials throughout a 45-minute set. His music is related less to European atonality or hectic TV than to the riffing momentum of the Count Basie band. Of course, Taylor's music isn't to every taste, but it's so earthy and so full of dancing energy, it makes me suspect Taylor's problem isn't that his music's hard to listen to, but that some of his detractors refuse to listen.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed a reissue of Cecil Taylor's album Indent on the Freedom label. This is Fresh Air. Mountaintops, deserts, and lonely coves are sometimes described as empty places, and to some people, empty means useless. Writer Paul Grukow finds it essential to leave the comforts of home and take time to experience the wilderness and these empty places. When he returns home, he reflects on what he saw by writing essays. His collection of essays, The Necessity of Empty Places, is about his outings to the Sandhills of Nebraska, the Blue Mounds of Minnesota, the Bighorn Mountains of Wyoming, and other places in the West. Grukow lives on the prairie of southwestern Minnesota. I asked him if there are specific times in his life when he needs to head for the wilderness.
Well, I think the feeling hits me most often in the summertime. Partly that's a throwback to the days when I lived on the farm and when I understood, we were taught this vigorously from the beginning, that in the summertime, decent, honorable people were out doing some sort of physical work. I find it's very hard for me to write in the summer. It always has been, because I think I ought to be out doing something. And so in the summertime, I find myself heading into the hills.
I'd like to ask you to read a passage from
Sure.
your book. And I think this passage gives a sense of one of the things that appeals to you about picking up and leaving.
I like the idea of life lived at the edge. A spruce tree at the upper limits of the mountain tree line, thick and misshapen, shorn of its branches on its windward side, no more than shoulder high, although it may be a century old. Such a spruce speaks powerfully of the persistence of life. Every person who enters the wilderness goes in search of the same speech. A journey into the wilderness is a test of the will against the odds. Going into the wilderness, any wilderness, is a way of opening yourself to the possibility of danger and to the likelihood of discomfort at the least. There is the possibility of getting lost, of being trapped in a storm, of confronting an angry animal, of falling. There are the certain hardships of arduous walks, of exposure to cold, heat, wind, rain, of sleeping on the ground, of solitude. To be alone is sometimes the most difficult challenge of all. It is, in itself, an art for which we are ill-equipped, both by training and by experience. To confront the unknown and to meet its challenges is to be admitted into a permanently enlarged world, just as the tortured spruce tree at the edge of the upper forest enlarges and frees the world for trees, so our encounters with wilderness widen and free us.
You know, one of the things that interested me about that passage is that, you know, I think of some people going out into the wilderness for real macho reasons to see if they can conquer, and others for more meditative reasons, and I kind of put you in the more meditative category, but in that passage you really talk about the challenge, about the test of will against the odds.
I think one of the things that we often miss in our lives, although I must say I feel that when I go to a place like New York City, is the sense of fear. Most of us live our lives in comfortable cocoons. We go from houses to jobs, and if we survive the office politics, we know that we can survive life as a whole. But we really need to feel, I think, challenged by that physical world, and we just don't get it in everyday life. So I really do think that's one of the reasons to go into the wilderness, although, as you say, I don't like that that macho stuff that sometimes gets sold. I don't think going into the wilderness and racing against time and climbing the highest mountains and doing it in the shortest amount of time, that sort of thing doesn't appeal particularly to me. I think the best way to go into any wilderness is the best way to go into a landscape, no matter where it is, and that's slowly and with your eyes and ears open and with your sense of touch alive, and to experience second by second what happens there.
Do you see your essays fitting into a larger literary tradition?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's a tradition that was started by Gilbert White in 18th century England, and carried forward in this country first by Thoreau and then by a long line of wonderful writers coming down into this century toward such writers as Lauren Isley, a wonderful Nebraska writer, I think, who ought to be much better known, and to modern people like John McPhee and Annie Dillard. It's a great tradition, and it's a tradition that is really sort of left out of our cultural life in some way. It doesn't get into the science departments of universities because it's not quite a science, actually, this natural history stuff, and it doesn't get into literature departments because it's not conventional literature, so it's a sort of lost force in specialized terms, but one that's very much alive, I think, in our literature, and an important one. Mm-hmm. I see myself very much as part of it.
One of the chapters in your new book is about going mountain climbing with a friend.
Yes.
And as you got higher, you both got altitude sickness. Your symptoms were a pounding head. His
yes.
symptoms were an upset stomach, severe diarrhea. I'd like you to read the passage right after you described his symptoms and your symptoms and the increasing distress you were both experiencing.
The gruesome truth of walking in high places, yes. The art of wilderness walking is the knack of adjusting your expectations to reality, of taking circumstances as they come. You enter the wilderness expecting to find the expansiveness of space, the intimacy of caverns, the solitude of rocks, the music of birds, the silence of stars, the fragrances of flowers, the depths of waters. And you do. But you also encounter fogs and mists, sudden rain showers, the whining of mosquitoes, the bites of flies, trails that disappear, rocks that stub your toes, the cloying heat of midday, the gnawing cold of midnight, lumpy beds, aching muscles. One gray morning, you awaken unrested, pull on your stinking socks, find that the stove won't light, force yourself to eat a nauseating breakfast of cold instant oatmeal, which you remember now that you have always hated and can't imagine why you brought, and surveying the skies, see that you are going to spend the day walking in a drizzle. This is the litmus test, the moment when you expect a good companion to say, without a hint of irony, "Well, ready whenever you are."
Well, this story has a happy ending. You and your friend make it to the summit. You have
yep.
lunch there and then head back. But I was wondering if you ever turned around, if you ever felt overpowered by the symptoms or fear or the discomfort.
Well, there's one occasion when I was walking in the Beartooth Mountains on the Wyoming-Montana border and somehow had gotten myself hopelessly lost and had wandered for 3 or 4 days through that wilderness with 2 maps in my hand, one for the Wyoming part of the wilderness and one for the Montana part of it, uncertain which map even to look at because I didn't know what state I was in. And it got very cold. It got down into at least the low 20s and started to drizzle, and I was lonely. I'd been on the road for a long time and terribly miserable. And I did turn back finally. I figured out where I was and got myself turned around, and I was absolutely headed out of that wilderness, and I was never going to go into one again in my life. And along the way, I stopped at a wonderful alpine lake, and the sun came out, and a raven came to entertain me, and the world looked sweet, and I was lost again, and the mosquitoes had gone away, and I went for another 5 days.
As much as you love different landscapes and the outdoors, you really hate nature shows. You're very critical of nature shows, and I want you to explain your criticisms.
Well, they serve a purpose of a kind, I suppose. They get people excited about a subject that certainly I'm very much interested in. But I think there's a lot of trivializing that that goes on in that sort of program. There's a tendency to suggest that that nature is an amusement and simply a set of amazing oddities, and the sense that we really need is the sense that we ourselves are part of nature, that we're one with it, that it isn't something we look at from a distance with a vague sense of interest, but something that we embrace, something that we recognize as we recognize members of our own family.
Okay, well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Paul Grukow's book of essays, The Necessity of Empty Places, is published by St. Martin's Press. He spoke to us from station KSJN in St. Paul. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with co-host Linda Wertheimer. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry.
What's coming up today?
Well, China is still our lead story. We've had a variety of reports from China. Apparently, there are some troops that are now moving toward the center of the city. They're still some miles away. They've left their troop convoys because the vehicles weren't able to get through all the people, but individual soldiers have apparently formed columns and headed for the center of the city. We're going to try to discover what is going on with the government of China, what is happening within the Chinese leadership, and take a look at corruption in China, the problems that that started these demonstrations in the first place.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The show that made white linen sports jackets and no socks a police uniform broadcast its final episode this past weekend. Television critic David Bianculli looks back on Miami Vice.
Miami Vice didn't go out in a blaze of glory on Sunday, but it sure went out with a blaze of gunfire. The plot had Crockett and Tubbs trying to bring to Miami a foreign general from some Latin American country on the brink of revolution. And almost everywhere they turned, the gunfire was almost as loud as the rock music on the soundtrack. Because this was the series finale, these scenes were a little more suspenseful than usual. There was actually the chance this time that something terrible might happen to the central figures in this series. But don't worry. Crockett Tubbs and Crockett's skillion-dollar automobile all survive without a scratch. Instead, Crockett and Tubbs got tired of working for crooked police chiefs and seeing drug dealers and murderers slip through their nets, so they threw down their badges and quit. Lieutenant Castillo, their boss, tried to talk them out of resigning. But the way Edward James Olmos plays Castillo, persuasive speaking isn't exactly the guy's strong suit.
You don't have to do this. Been a long time coming anyway. I'll back you.
Thanks, Lieutenant. But there's no other way.
Think about this.
They thought about it, and they quit, and the series ended with one of the dullest finales ever contrived. Crockett and Tubbs shook hands, said goodbye, and Crockett offered Tubbs a ride to the airport. Then there was a video montage of scenes from the show's five-year run, and that was it. You might think of it as poetic justice, so to speak, that Crockett and Tubbs walk away because they're tired of the same old thing. Viewers of Miami Vice started getting tired about 2 years ago of the same old plots, the same new music, and the same snazzy photography. Miami Vice, like Moonlighting, stood out from other TV shows and became a hit because it looked and sounded so different. But after a while, all of its different episodes began to look and sound pretty much the same. The Miami Vice finale allowed series stars Don Johnson and Philip Michael Thomas to say goodbye to each other, but otherwise it was far from a satisfactory ending. Michael Talbot, as Switek, was given one meaty scene, but the show's other regular cast members, especially the ones playing the female cops, were virtually ignored. There wasn't even a scene in which Crockett and Tubbs said goodbye to their friends and colleagues on the Miami Vice squad. Instead, Crockett embraced his steering wheel and rode off into the Miami sunset. The way to remember Miami Vice fondly is to forget about its finale and think back to the opening episode, the one where Crockett drove down the street in a different car as the Phil Collins song In the Air Tonight played on the soundtrack. That was when Miami Vice was fresh and proved that TV could tell stories using rock music as a key ingredient. The last episode, though, didn't use its music well, didn't use Miami much at all, and, like Crockett and Tubbs' five-year battle against drug dealers and arms merchants, didn't make much of a dent.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, computer animator John Lasseter tells us about the difficulty of getting a machine to understand human movement. Lasseter's latest cartoon, The Tin Toy, is the first computer animation to win the Academy Award for animation. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles a pair of 70s avant-garde bands, The Residents and Pere Ubu. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Russia House. It's the new spy thriller from John le Carré, who wrote the bestsellers The Spy Who Came In from the Cold and Tinker Tailor's Soldier Spy. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton and Ed Ockerty. Research assistants from Christopher Cook and Laura Sivitz. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. NPR, National Public Radio.